Two Pints in a Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue.
Hello.
Bradley J, how are you? This is Dinky Dawson calling.
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm not too bad today. I had a little bit off from the dialysis one day, so I'm feeling peppy. I've just talked with Marshall Goldberg from the old Boston Tea Party days.
And, good.
And now I'm here. We are on Two Pints in a Corner with Bradley J, and Peter Limbo's in with us here at the studio here in Plymouth. And so we're going to talk about the Channel days, Bradley.
Okay.
What was the first time you ever went in there, not working, but just watching?
Well, I don't remember the band, but I came to Boston around 1979, so it probably was one of those bands around the 1979 time. Big bands then were, I mean, that was the year when so many great bands had their first album, like U2 and XTC and Squeeze and Pretenders and the Specials. So it probably was one of those types of bands. But that's interesting. I cannot remember the very first band. But I do remember clearly walking all the time. A big part of going to the Channel was walking from South Station across the bridge and then taking a right. And then a left and then a right and going in that big old place, which was hanging over the water. It was built on pilings and it hung over the water. And on a...
Actually, Bradley, to tell you the truth, it hung over the Boston Dump. The original...
The Boston Dump.
The original Boston Dump from the days of the Tea Party.
And I can remember when we went up to the over the ceiling and they were all dead rats. Up there, they had just died and rotted. And they
What were you doing up in the ceiling?
Well, I was running the Channel for a little while, and we had every place we had it painted, and you know, we were going to replace some of the drop ceiling tiles, and more than just the tiles dropped out.
I took it down.
What year would that have been?
Oh God, I don't even remember. I mean. You know, all of my bands played there. I was there at least once a week, if not twice. But I put together a group.
Oh, this is 60. This is 70. This is 88, 89.
Yeah, it was
90.
Late 80s.
So that was when it's a different drop ceiling he's talking about, because in 86 I dropped the whole ceiling in the main club. But you're talking of
in the office.
Yeah. In the office. And the little club, we already did the same thing. We dropped that ceiling down, and as you Peter said, in fact, one of the stories that Patrick Norton, one of the engineers, was talking about, he says he was scared to go in the office because he kept hearing bang, bang, bang. And what it was the shooting rats that were trying to get into the popcorn machine.
Oh, really?
Well, I can remember Artie Lane, who sold popcorn at the concession stand.
Yeah.
She came out and got me one day, and there was that sealed room,
yeah,
and it was all, like, iron-lined. I mean, there was no way for anybody to get in there. It was a cold room, and that's where the pizza was stored.
Yeah.
And she took me in there and said, you're not going to believe this. And the rats had eaten right through the cardboard boxes,
yeah,
and eaten the pizza.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how the hell did they get in here? I mean— They don't have any bones, but the openings were just slivers.
We could never remember.
It was unbelievable.
It was unbelievable. So the first time that you went and did a show there, because you worked there a couple of times and stuff as well as...
Well, I worked there. I did a lot of emceeing.
Yeah,
and
that's
also,
right.
That's right. But also, I was a DJ there on Tuesday nights. For
really?
New music nights. First, I think...
Wow.
Before me, Tammy Heidi.
Tammy, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right. I used to go on those new music nights to try to find bands to work with, but
a lot of times it was pretty empty. There was a lot of empty space on those nights. It wasn't very crowded.
Well, the bands had to sell tickets in order to get paid. They had to get their friends to come and stuff. But
right, but I do remember how great the sound system was. There was a particularly interesting sound system hanging up over the dance floor. And the dance floor looked like something from Star Wars.
Yeah, that's right.
It was a disco, kind of a disco dance floor with lights underneath that had a pattern of they would move. But the sound system was super good. And so I would, since there was nobody in the dance floor, I would just play songs I liked. It didn't matter.
There you go. That's the whole point about the place.
Another thing, well, as you mentioned, a lot of MC gigs.
Yeah.
And I remember specifically, well, I guess my favorite one was Spinal Tap. I actually got.
Oh, yeah.
You did that? Oh, you did that because I.
Yeah, I got to MC for Spinal Tap. And actually, Spinal Tap, they were really pretty good band. And somebody, maybe it was you, told me that there was a leak in the ceiling that night and a bucket of water on stage or something like that.
There was a massive leak in off. There were water was coming through the false ceiling. And it was dripping all over them, and all of a sudden it went gaboosh all over them and all of the gear and all this, that, and the other. And that was the end of that thing. And so I wasn't there at that time because that was in 1983, I think it was, Spinal Tap. I will let you know in 1 second.
All I remember is that huge poster that was framed in the office, signed
by
the entire band.
That caught fire, actually, in a friend's garage. That was July 1984, Spinal Tap.
Spinal Tap? Wow, that was early on. That's funny how...
That's what I'm saying. It was early on. That was one of the things we're going to talk with Warren about next week, is about how he got Spinal Tap for the actual show, which was phenomenal. And it's a good story. But at the end of the day, you did that. That was really one of the top shows in that time period that came through, I thought. And I wasn't there. I was still on the road with Mamas and Papas at that time.
And we all know that that pissed Don Laura off.
Oh, totally pissed him off. But that was the coup that Warren got. They did a real good job.
Yeah,
that
was
one.
A coup.
It was a good one.
So why was Don Laura upset?
Because we got Spinal Tap in there, which was a big deal at that time because of the movie situation still. It was still a big deal, you know?
Anytime somebody beat Don out, be it Warren or Frank Russo to do a show on the channel, he just got pissed.
Yeah, it's just the nature of the beastie. He put clauses on things that they couldn't play within that 50-mile radius and stuff like that. Well, we were playing with different kinds of acts, though, than what he would be able to put on a Paradise or any of the other places, you know? And at the end of the day, that's why it was so unique, the channel. And, I mean, I remember you doing running around in there, doing stuff, and then there was artists that came out of BCN that had been there to do promotions, and you asked them to come down and this, that, and the other, and you had them sat one of them I remember was sat on the bar looking at this, that, and the other. And I know you were up there chatting with different one of them because you'd had them at BCN that day, you know.
What year was Warren there?
Warren there was from 82 onwards until the end. All the way through.
Wow.
It was right there at the beginning.
Until the gangsters brought it.
Well, we don't go there, but yeah, that's what it's. What the end was, and that's we all disappeared and took our things and said, sorry, it's not for us, and that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, you did the peak periods from the time that you, in fact, one show I'm going to tell you right now that Bradley J did was January 22nd, 1985, and you were DJing for New Generation, Chinese Church, and Omnix. I mean, talk about that. I mean, that was a weird show. But yeah,
Was that one of those new music nights, or was this a different night?
That's a different night.
Okay. Wow. Jeez. Yes. And let's see. And then don't forget about the lunchtime concerts. That was a big.
You know, it's funny. I was thinking about that driving over today.
Lunchtime.
I used to leave my office, drive down to the channel, watch the lunchtime show, go to the North End, and just have an afternoon to myself. And I used to love those lunchtime concerts. It didn't matter who was playing.
For those people who don't know what that is, a lunchtime concert, the radio station WBCN would work with a record company and get they'd take the band and they'd go to a club, a lot of times a channel. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, that your first beer was free.
And it was. One beer free and free hot dogs. Remember, what is in a free hot dog?
Free hot dogs. And some of the bands, let me see, was Y&T one of those bands? There was one band that had a singer off stage hidden behind everything, like a backup singer that was not on stage.
I love it.
Pretty weird.
I wasn't there for that kind of stuff because I was there for some weird stuff, but I didn't come till 86 with my sound system and stuff. And, you know, you were already there and well-established doing DJing. I mean, February 3rd, 1985, you were DJing Clarkson, Nine Lives, Rusty, Top Hat, Press for Time, and, you know, the new music stuff that was...
How do you know when I was DJing? Do you have a...
Because I've got every database from every year. I spent a year going to Phoenix and talking with the Phoenix people, and all I did is take all the Phoenix adverts, and I've copied it all. I have cases full of...
It would say so-and-so band featuring DJ...
DJ McCart, Carmel Leader, DJ Bradley J. Okay, March 5th, 1985. You Boys, Control You, Terror Architectural Metaphor. They're the new music stuff. And you were doing that stuff. And Bradley J, March 6th, 1985. Aussie Casual 3, Window X, and the Manical Reason. Manical Reason. Wow.
Jeez. Those are good gigs, man. It's fun. It's always fun to get on stage and wind a crowd up and then leave.
That's it. I mean, you did so many of them. I mean, April 2nd, 85, KO Historic Cadets, Lazarus, The Cut, Bradley J. And then you had April 9th, 85, Azul Reflector, a boy hits his dog 18 plus, Bradley J. 18 plus nights were interesting because they all wore, everybody that was over 18 plus could buy a drink. And then we had the armbands. Wristbands, that was what it was, and stuff.
Yeah. How did you ever get the database?
I went to the Phoenix every day for nearly a year when I started getting cancer. And I went to the Phoenix, and I had Kevin Almer, the Black Star Line, a DJ, go with me to help me. And we saw everyone there that we knew. In fact, it was worth going there to do that because then people had every damn show that was advertised. And it was great to get this database put together, and it took a long time to do. But at the end of the day, it's not final because I've found a couple of new ones that came in that we didn't have advertised in the Phoenix. There was an AIDS benefit that my engineer Patrick Norton did that wasn't even advertised in anything because they'd already done it through their network. And we didn't. It was one of them quick shows that we used to get, you know, for a benefit.
And probably like the motorcycle night.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Which was hell on earth to work on.
Yeah, it was, but it's like I said to Marshall Goldberg earlier, a friend from He had the problems when at the Tea Party, when he was doing the Tea Party in the 60s, with the not the Hells Angels, but the other band that was used to come through, Devil's Disciples, and they were uh-huh. he was worried and this, that, and the other. And he made an agreement and this, that, and the other, and Marshall let the guys in, you know, without any trouble or anything. And we did the same, even with the Hells Angels there.
I can remember, you know, all the bartenders refused to work. Nobody wanted to meet. There were guys with guns on the roof.
Yeah, but the thing is, what we had no problems because they were really wanted to just play.
They were in control of themselves.
In control.
Yeah, they were.
And looking after stuff. And then when the Disciples came with it, it was like, over 300 motorbikes out front, and then all of a sudden there's another couple of hundred out there with the different kind of bikers, and the heads guys went out, Mario and the guys from the Angels.
Oh God, Mario! Holy cow, Dinky!
And went out and to chatted with them, and they all appreciated it, and they said thank you. We just didn't, so they are really looking at each other's bikes and that kind of stuff, and then they took off and drove off. But they were just listening to what was going on in the music and stuff going in there. And they wished they could come in, but they wouldn't be able to do it because it was a special night for Angels. And the Angels went out, Mario, and went in and told them.
Well, we all know what it really was a night for, but that's a whole different story.
Oh, yeah. It was pretty interesting.
did you guys have issues with people sneaking their friends in the double door
in the rear. There was, of course, there was occasionally somebody had put, you know, got in the back door. A doorman or a bouncer would let somebody in here and there, depending on what it was, and who it was, and so on and so forth. But they weren't like, it wasn't every day. There was because the people that knew how to get in for free come to the right to the door, and just walked in because they were allowed in.
Right. People knew who people were. Yeah,
I mean that was the beauty of the channel. I mean that was the whole thing about it. The general public didn't know that what was, you know, going on with all the people that knew what were going there every day. You know, that kind of stuff, because there was so much variety of music from different genres of music. And I'm sure, have you got some fun ones to say about some of the genres? Okay, let's have a chat with that one.
So my strongest memory of a moment of at the channel was Nina Hagen.
Oh yeah.
Wow.
Nina Hagen
played
to a super duper packed house.
Yeah.
It was, and the floor was going up and down on the side. Over on the side where the pilings are.
Yeah.
It felt like it was going to cave in, but that place was, I feel like it was hot, and I feel like it was completely packed. And I remember she covered David Bowie's Heroes, and it was just such a big deal. But she was great, and it was a big, big, big musical moment in Boston, I thought.
I'd say that there's been many musical moments at the channel because of the diversity of acts and artists that came through. Oh, I like that Nina Hagen one. I enjoyed that one. That was a good one.
And as I scan my memory banks, I remember, I think I saw Au Pair, or some people call them the Au Pairs, but Au Pair, AUPAIR, Jesus and Mary Chain.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
And Echo and the Bunnymen.
Echo and the Bunny, yeah. Ooh, that's another one that was interesting. Echo and the Bunnymen.
And I saw Nick Cave there. I remember talking to Nick Cave before the show and asking him if he wanted anything, any coffee or anything. He was nice. And I think Tones on Tail, which are the people, the Bauhaus people, with Daniel Ash, Tones on Tail. And of course, the Cramps a bunch.
Oh yeah,
yeah, they were like a regular.
They were a regular. We did a New Year's with the Cramps.
That's right. Because it was usually my Halloween people, either the Stompers or Fahrenheit that did New Year's Eve. But that night,
didn't they do Halloween? Didn't Cramps do Halloween?
Probably.
Maybe it's my imagination.
No, it could have. I mean,
that would make sense, though.
And Iggy Pop.
That's an album, you know. That Iggy Pop's an album. Live at the Channel. Wow. Iggy Pop.
Wow. And there was a weird guy named Nash the Slash, who was a solo artist, and he had these loops, and he played the electric violin, and he dressed in like he had been in a car accident or something.
I love that.
Gauze bandages all over his face, and a construction hat with burn holes in it.
You know, man, you've got a memory that's scary. Okay, I'm going to tell you right now.
And he had loops, and he would start at loop, and it would loop up. Nash the Slash, solo artist. He might have been Canadian, but it was really, really impressive.
Wow.
And of course, those artists that weren't that well known, you could get right up front, which is great. I used to watch from the side. I used to enjoy watching from the side, kind of over on the dance floor side, and because nobody would go on the side, and you could get really close and see what was going on
the stage and stuff. That was good.
Yep. So I'm trying to think of. I remember early on, Peter Dayton Band, a local band.
Oh yeah,
Peter Dayton Band. Yeah, you guys remember Peter Dayton?
I remember
band?
The name. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And. Jeez, did I say Jesus Mary Chain? Maybe the Wolfgang Press. These are like I worked at WZBC, the college station too. So a lot of those college radio bands would come through, the Wolfgang Press was great, and I liked the sound. The sound was always really good in there. It was it didn't feel corporate. It felt like a real experience. One time, for a while, my friend he was living in, there were these if you go out the front door through the parking lot and keep going, there were these like factory warehouse spaces.
Yeah, right across the street.
Yeah.
And he lived in one of them. And I don't think he was supposed to be living in them.
No, there was.
And he had to heat his house. He had to heat the place with a gas stove.
Yeah, there was lofts across there, and those lofts were being lived in. I came in, we just did the sound system, and Andrew was running the production, Andrew Arsenal, and the crews were different when I came in because I brought in some of my personnel, David Wendling, Andrew, Patrick Norton, then Scott Perlman, and then eventually there was Tim Miller, Tim Hines, and all the guys that work for us and work for in the lighting, Martin Favor after DB.
Oh, Martin, yeah. Wow.
We lost DB, by the way. He would have been great with us on this because he wanted to do it, and he passed
away. Who brought you in? How did you happen to...
Harry had been after me for a while because he'd been chasing me down at South Shore Music Circus. He kept coming down there to get me to come in because I'd been doing MRI. I quit on the road in 79 after I'd done B.B. King in Russia and then Ambrosia on the tour. I was doing that with they were opening for Little River Band, and Little River Band were opening for us on different venues. And we had number one with How Much I Feel at that time and what have you, and so it was fun. And then I started working with Mamas and Papas. I helped reform them in 1980 with our friend Carlos Burnell and Al Hirsch, and we put them back together and got them on the road. And so I didn't want to go with the sound system, but Harry kept, because I was just doing the summer with that in the tents, South Shore Music Circus. And then Harry kept coming over and saying, we'd like you to come and look at the channel and this, that, and the other. I'd already been in there in 82 to watch a group friend of ours from the South Shore, State of Mind. And I enjoyed them. I enjoyed what was going on. I enjoyed how it worked. And I loved the venue because it was so big.
Was that Jeff Morley's band?
No. This was way before that. Was I forgot right now. Nancy will have to get me.
It'll come back to you.
State of Mind. David Bouage and running it. It was... Rob playing guitar, Big Terrace, and Keith Reed on keyboards, and Steve on drums. It was fun, but
was it you that put that sound system over the dance floor? That was yours?
No, that was the house's one. That was the house originally, and they had another one that came in to do the main PA. And I changed the main PA. I kept the house stuff because it was pretty fun. It was cool. It sounded good. It did the room all right. And then I hooked my PA up to that. When you were DJing and stuff, you would be getting the benefit of the big PA as well as the one in the, over the dance floor.
That was your own PA that you owned, and you would take it.
Bradley, I built that in 1972.
You built it?
I built it from scratch in 1972. Cabinets, speakers, the amplifiers, the mixers. I didn't bring my big mixers in because nobody would understand them because there was no... they were all knobs, black knobs everywhere, but there was no controls in respect of numbers on them. It was just black paint and black knobs on there. Yeah, you got to use your ear. That's what I said. Every one of them engineers that come in, you're going to use my stuff, you do engineer. You got to use your ear. But what I did then is change it over to the mixing console to a standard Yamaha PM2000 after the 1000 I put in originally, and put the big 2000 in there so they could put in gates and all these toys that people wanted and effects and everything at that time, which changed in the 80s. And there was the gated reverbs were coming in, the SPX 90s and 900s and stuff like that, and everybody was using them. That kind of, and all the sounds. And you could get it out of that system. You could feel it. We did Man of War. There was about 138 at the back when Man of War came on there. And then I said, it's not loud enough. And I turned it up, and the Man of War people freaked because, you see, I'd done also a separate vocal system that I hung on a separate thing, but I didn't tell anybody. And then what I did is when I ended up mixing, I just mixed that in there, and they got crystal clear vocals from everybody. And then when I saw some of the engineers that knew how to use it, I let them use it and stuff because they understood now we've got a system that's got an extra vocal thing rather than putting any instruments to it. It was the vocals, and it was just crystal clear at that point. So it was a big system. By the way, I'm just going back to one thing we talked about, the cramps. The cramps is December 24th. No, sorry, December 28th, 1988.
Oh wow!
That was the big cramps day that I remember, because it had Condo Pickneys and Plan 9 opening for them, and that was the reason I brought that up is because they did play a lot and they were so good when they were playing, and everybody that came out from Stompers to Fools to all the individuals that came out to see them play was a big deal. And, and Rick Berlin and all that crowd and all the wonderful stuff that he used to bring in.
By the way, Rick Berlin had a big birthday party.
He's still young. He was only 80.
And so I went to that. And
it was really?
Oh, cool. Cool, Bradley. I like
that. It lasted a long time. And it lasted from like 6 to... 12 or something like that.
That's Rick. He has a lot of friends, a lot of musicians, and a lot of talent around him.
Yeah, sometimes there were about 10, 12 people on the stage.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was Robin Lane was there.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Chad Busses. And Laurie Sargent was there.
Oh, my. That's great. Laurie was great. She was great. Always great.
And Talia Zadek was there. She has her own band that they toured around Eastern Europe a couple of years ago, I guess. And I'm trying to think, but it was quite a thing. It was at the Brighton Music Hall, and it was pretty full.
I would have expected that to happen. I've not been out, unfortunately, to any event for 5-6 years. With the illnesses I've had and what have you, it's too much to go out for me at night, and I'm in bed by 8 o'clock at night and up at 4.
Yeah, but you've seen enough bands to last a lifetime.
I've worked with enough bands to last many generations, All through the 70s, I worked with so many different bands with the sound system, but also with the big stuff. You know, I mean, the big stuff being from Fleetwood to the Byrds to Mahavishnu Orchestra to Lou Reed, Steely Dan. I did three albums with Steely, and also the live stuff. Oh, there's a live one that I wish would come out and we could do.
You know, you're talking about the Byrds. I can remember one of the best shows that I ever saw at the Channel was Gene Clark, Mike Clark from the original Byrds, surrounded by some of the greatest Nashville sessions.
Yeah, Sneaky Pete was
Sneaky
there.
Sneaky Pete was there.
Unbelievable.
What a night that was. And I was a huge Byrds fan when I was growing up. That was a night and a half.
I didn't do that. I was done in 1972 with Roger and the Byrds at that time, and I left when.
Clarence White was in the band when you. Yeah.
I had Clarence.
Hey, Dinky. People probably ask you this all the time, but I don't know the answer, and I'm curious. It's like, how did you become? You know, how'd you get in the biz like that? How'd you go from being a regular high school student or whatever?
No, I was.
You know, to
being you. I'd just taken my City and Guilds in iron and steel. I have my degrees in iron and steel. I've been in the steelworks. I'd been working on stuff in the steelworks and new projects, like fusion welding that had never happened before. And I was in charge of this one machine that used to send big reels of steel to America to have champion spark plugs be made out from it because it was that kind of quality steel. I left that and I was a DJ, you see. I was a DJ in our own clubs, Dinky and Dave in the Pendulum Club. And then I go with Peter Stringfellow, the number one DJ in England at the time. We go to a show on TV. I'd go dancing on the TV on Ready, Steady, Go.
And, how'd you meet him? I mean, how'd you go from being... working in the steel.
I just went to the club. I just went to the club, and I and Peter really loved what we were doing and having fun with him. And his DJing was, you know, because it's live. There was no radio stuff that we were doing at all. It wasn't that. And that was my style, you know, the live things. Everybody had to be live. So we did real well and doing this. One afternoon, I just got back from doing a Germany. I was in Germany a month in Kiel doing the DJ
at the
Star Club in Kiel. The Ambassador was club was the other one, but the Star Palace was the one I did up in Kiel. I drove back my Mini. I took my Mini up there. I drove back my Mini back to England. I got back at home, and there was this note waiting for me from my mum. I got a telephone call from another roadie friend of mine from Alan Bouncett, if you ever remember that band who did Little Leslie. Wonderful. This guy is wonderful band, Alan Bound people. Anyway, Steve, who was in charge of there, was this roadie, and I didn't know what a roadie was or anything. But he said that there's this band out in London that you'd like to maybe work for. Here's the number. Go call the manager up. I said, well, let's see what they got. And I called this manager up at Clifford Davis, Clifford Adams, really, his name. And he was a star of his own, but he was booking this group called Fleetwood Mac. And he was managing them. And so I ended up driving. I got to London. I went to this Muse, and I ended up picking up a van with all this old gear that was falling apart, literally. And this big, long guy called Mick Fleetwood helped me in with the gear and the drums and everything. I said, I'm going to go home back to Sheffield with this stuff, and I'll fix it all up. He says, that would be wonderful. So I went and rewired all Peter Green's amplifiers, the Fenders, Danny wasn't there then at that time. But the first show I come to, I have to come down to this Toby Dog place, and it's a bar, and upstairs in the bar, and I have to take this gear upstairs. I thought, this is a bit much, this work. And then this young kid came up and said, are you with Fleetwood Mac? I says, yeah, this is Fleetwood Mac here. So he says, well, I'll give you a hand. And he gave me a hand and put it up there. And he says, you put Peter here, you put Peter there, put there. This kid's called Danny Kerwin. And I says, Danny Kerwin, you're going to be part of this band. This is your first gig. He says, yeah. I says, well, you don't touch this. I'm supposed to touch all this gear. he starts laughing. And I says, not to worry. Then the band showed up and they were all freaked out. Everything was in order for them. And when Peter turned on the guitar amp, he goes, oh, my God, we're back to realism and that kind of stuff. And the next thing, they're in love with me just because I did the gear. And gave him the beer on time, ran around and got the beer for him everything in the pub. And then I come downstairs after I clean up everything and I'm going to put the stuff in the bar, the van, and I get this thing from Clifford. Clifford called me and goes, Dingy? And I says, yes. I know he was doing this whole thing. And he says, welcome to Fleetwood Mac. You are unbelievable. I says, what have I done? I'm just doing what I know, you know. And it's because I could do the electronics and help it and do all the other stuff. And then it moved on from there. I built Fleetwood Mac's, had them orange amplifiers I had built because of the quality of the amplifier themselves. Was superb for guitars and wonderful for bass and stuff. And then I eventually, 69, I had Charlie Watkins because Mick wanted me to go over to Wem because they'd used him in 67 at the Bath Festival, which is the biggest festival at that time. Charlie Watkins owned Wem. Now, Charlie was a genius. Charlie invented so much stuff that helped the British invasion here in every level. Unbelievable amount of stuff. And the people he worked with in the 50s, all the 50s acts that came from America, Buddy Holly, all of them that came through and stuff, he had the system. But every sound system that you saw in a festival in the 60s was Charlie, was Wem, wow. Every one of them. And they were all done for free, Bradley. Every one of those he did for free because he loved the music. He loved the people. He actually, him and Jimi Hendrix used to play together in the afternoon while they were having lunch before Jimmy went to work on his guitar stuff. He was playing the accordion. They were playing and Jimmy was writing songs on the accordion. And Charlie and him were playing because Charlie was a master accordion. Eventually, he designed the MIDI-ing for an accordion, and he's put that together, and that's one of the last things he'd done in his life and stuff. You know, it was just phenomenal stuff that he designed. And
did you say you're from Sheffield? Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I'm from a place called Rotherham. It's a little village I'm from Greasbury, which is only 20 miles from Sheffield. Sheffield is where we had all my friends, the Vance Arnold, as you know, as Joe Cocker. Dave Berry's got to be 90 and he's still performing. And he's still performing the same venues he did when in the 60s. And he's really good.
I'm a big giant fan of the Sheffield music scene. They had such a cool late 70s, early 80s. Human League is from Sheffield.
Yeah, but you see, before that, it all stemmed from the 50s and 60s, from the folk era to the rock era, and then the clubs, the wonderful club like Esquire that I just talked about earlier with Marshall, about seeing Joe Vance Arnold singing Georgia on My Mind, and I cried. I absolutely cried on it. I've never done that to an artist before. And Joe and I became close friends. And unbelievable. There's a 67 recording we did at the Mojo Club for the University of Sheffield called Rag Week, because that was a week that they do these crazy stuff. They put little Mini Coopers on top of mobile vehicles and drive them out of town and drop them off and, the weird stuff. But it was just it was just wonderful. But Joe did a song that he put, and he did Adverb on it and did all these new lyrics that nobody had ever heard of and just blew everybody away. It's out on a single or an EP, but if you look online, you can get it on there and you will believe some of the stuff that Joe did. And
There's a movie called Made in Sheffield about the Sheffield
scene. That's me. I'm in there. I'm doing the dancing. I'm one of the dancers on the on that.
I would really? I would pay to see that.
Oh, I'm 1965.
Which one? Which band are you dancing to? Which band?
No, this is the Mojo Club. This is when we were doing the Mojo, when it was the biggest club in Sheffield area. Groups like, I'd get, Peter would bring all-nighters. We'd close the club at 11 o'clock, usually, you know, and then Peter would open the club up again for an all-nighter starting at 12. And it would go till 7 in the morning. And you would get the groups that had been playing up north coming through to go back to London. Sort of this group called the Steam Packet. Do you remember them? Rod Stewart, the Steam Packet, Julie Driscoll, Brian Auger.
No, well, I know the Brian Auger name, yeah. But I don't remember the name of the band.
You wouldn't believe it. I mean, Rod came in that night, the first night. I couldn't believe it. He... went into the cloakroom, took his coat off, and he was handling, getting the coats from the girls. Because at that time, all the girls were wearing like negligees, especially on all-nighters. They were just wearing negligees. So it was like, oh, interesting. You know, so he was checking the chicks out as the birds out as they were doing the clothes. So when he got up on stage, the girls were going, oh, you know, because it was amazing. Look. I saw Stevie Wonder. I saw Ike and Tina Turner. Ina Inez and stuff like that. But right with 6 inches away from my face, the stage was, you know, like the channel stage was high, but you could get close to it and look at the channel and you could touch the people. Well, this one was 1.5 feet and you would touch... Stevie Wonder. You would touch the... He actually was so absolutely hammered by the place that the Saturday night, he refused to leave. He wanted to stay. And so Coral and Peter Stringfellow at the time had him in the apartment with the big dog. And he stayed overnight and he wouldn't go until he did another show in the afternoon the next day. And remember, there was no radio for us to go to advertise that. So what we used to do is send all our crews out on their scooters and my minis and all the MGs and all that stuff to Nottingham, to Manchester Twisted Wheel, Nottingham, the Dungeon, and to different all-night clubs and say, OK, Stevie Wonder's going to be playing here Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock. Come down to the Mojo. And we had 3,000 people trying to get in. Door.
Wow.
It's the happening scene. You see, that's why I love the channel, because you would close the clubs around here at 12 and 1 because of the licensing, but we were open till 2 and we wouldn't put in any of the main acts on until midnight. So you got
that big second rush of people coming
in. It was unbelievable the amount of people that used to come through that door at midnight just to see the main acts and stuff like that. We were just shocked. But it was
how
wonderful.
Many people? What was the capacity of the channel?
1,600 legal. Legal.
We don't talk about it.
What's the most they were ever in there?
I don't know. Right. 25, maybe 3.
All I know is all my bands got paid at 1,600, and then all of a sudden the ticketing. The ticket report stopped.
Of course. But anyway, we won't go there. The bottom line of it is, there was quite a few lot for bands like Stompers, Fools, the local big bands, as I call them, that are still big bands and they never change because they're incredible musicians. And, you know, artists that you had with Rick there, the Rick Berlin shows were always dynamic shows. And different people on Ibrahim, then all the world music stuff,
the Sunday night stuff.
Oh, Sunday night was huge, huge.
How about bands like Unnatural Acts, Someone in the Somebody's.
You got all the punk stuff that Carter loves. Carter Allen loves all that punk stuff. He used to come down here all the time for the punks, especially, just because he couldn't believe it. And, you know, and then you'd have, you know, the real McCoy coming through England towards the end, that would be the new ones that really were going to make it, are already make it, made it. I'm trying to think of the individual solo act that came through that Tony went crazy over, Tony Reno and stuff. By the way, Tony's not with us, Bradley, because he's recovering from an illness that is going to take a while to recover from, and that's a bit of a stroke scene, what have you. But,
all right. Well, I hope he gets well as soon as possible.
Yeah, he would love to talk with everybody too, because that's his game. He loves it, and he loves what we did.
And he's a knowledgeable.
And he's knowledgeable like you would not believe. If it hadn't been for having the database, I'd be waiting for Tony to get well forever kind of stuff, because we all know that long takes. Peter's the same. He's hobbling around right now after being in Italy with the Pope. And no ifs, the buts. I mean, he was there, and him and his brother and the family, them guys had a great old time. They go all the time. He sat here with the Messina shirt on, and I don't mean John Messina, I mean Messina.
Which is where my grandparents came from.
A wonderful place and stuff.
I have a quick little story. I don't want to forget it. And that's about you. The first time I took a big trip was a 2-week Eurail trip. And I remember telling you that I was going to do it.
Yep.
And you told me to make sure I went to Kiel.
Kiel.
Because you had been to Kiel. You worked at Kiel, didn't you?
Yeah, I worked in the Star Club of Kiel. I lived upstairs to Star Club.
Yeah. And I told you that I was flying into Hamburg and out of some other city, but When I told you I was going into Hamburg, you said go to Kiel, and so I did. I actually went to Kiel because you told me.
Did you enjoy the waterfront there and everything?
Yeah. It was one of my first places I ever went.
When I was there, they had a Kiel week, and what it was all the navies around the world would come there for, you know, just to have fun and this, that, and the other. So you would get all the sailors coming into the clubs at night, and it was some of them were absolutely amazing. But I was trashed one night with my friend from the Ambassador Club, who was another DJ there, which was a real expensive nightclub. I mean, one drink was about 25 quid at that time. It was ridiculous. But it was, you know, for the main elite, so they would get the elite in there and whatever. Well, we got out, it was like 5:30 or 6 in the morning or something. Just daylight's coming up. I says, "Oh, let's go down to the wharf down there and see where these boats." So I drove steady along right onto the platform, and they said, and two guys with big guns come pulling out. "What are you doing here?" "Oh, we're just coming down here to get some jelly deals." Yeah, the next thing I know, they pointed over to this boat over there. He's just come in, go get them now. So we just went over to the jelly eel, and they're whipping off the heads of these eels and sucking them down.
Going, "Oh, whoa, God."
Yeah. I says, "Whoa, these guys are hardcore." No, Kiel is wonderful. Kiel's a great place. I had this young man that was working with us from Ireland. The band was from Ireland, and he was from England and stuff. And he changed his name to a guy that you probably know of. He's called Gary Glitter.
Yep. Wow.
His name was Paul Raven. He was on TV all the time in Germany with the band. The bass player was married to the woman who was the heir of the foundation of Adidas. And it was just an amazing showpiece band from like Ireland, really, really well done. And but he was the lead singer, and he did it soul like you wouldn't believe, this kid. And he actually sat in front of the mirror one night crying, "They don't love me." I says, "Them guys out there are half drunk. The most of them are American sailors that want you to sing your butt off, little guy. Go out there and do it." And he looked at me like, "Who are you?" I said, "I'm your DJ, so get out there." And stuff.
And wow. I did a lot of good stories.
Well,
back to the channel. Go ahead.
Go on, back to the channel. That's what I was about to ask.
Yeah, back to the channel. I was trying to think of other bands that must have played there. And like, for example, the Modern Lovers must have played there.
Oh, the Modern Lovers played there a bunch of times.
Mission of Burma.
Oh, Mission of Burma. All those bands played there because it was Boston's premier place to play for the local bands. That's why Don didn't have any of them things. Don Law didn't have any of that stuff. You got all the passes, people like what we used to do is the groups passing through.
The other thing is, from a managerial side of life, Don didn't pay.
Yeah.
The channel paid.
Yeah. That was the big thing. Channel paid. You got paid. I know you did, $50 or whatever it was.
What are some other ways that the channel was different from all the other clubs?
Because it had so many different genres of music. So many different ones. It could have three different kinds in a day. I mean, two of them was like the reggae at night after we've had heavy metal in the day, Stryper in the day. Then it would be changed over to King Sunny Idea, something at night, and things like that. It was such a variety of genres of music and personnel from that genre. People would come out of the woodwork for a particular sound, a particular thing in Boston. They would come out for, like I said, the Fools, the Stompers, because they knew they were going to get this wild, fun nights. And they were ready to party, and there was a party night. And that was basically what they got in. But when they come into the classy, in respect of the more dynamic stuff like Rick Berlin, like those kinds of acts, and then till the punk stuff started coming in, that was a whole different clientele. But I noticed, Bradley, that all the things that changed was when the metal started changing from straight good metal from the old days into hardcore death metal, Ponce metal, when they're all dressed up as puffs. But at the same time, the things that came through were spontaneous. There were, like you said, I mean, we talked about stuff Butthole Surfers, when I threw them out the back door because they set fire to the damn cymbal with lighter fluid. Those particular acts were more dramatic acts than anything to do with real quality of music, right. You know?
I'm looking at a list here, and you're right. There's such a wide range of types. Steppenwolf, Metallica.
There you go. You get the old school coming. You get the old school coming. You get even the Black Tide Affair. When we're doing the girls' night that we had for Halloween one year, we had Bonnie Raitt. And Bonnie gets up on that stage, and she looks at me, and the thing says, "Ah, I hope you don't say any stories about me and stuff," because we go back even further than the channel when we did shows together out in Lenox. She did one with me with...
You don't happen to have a total of number of bands that played there?
Well, I'd have to redo the whole database, but I would say thousands. Thousands of different ones. I mean, I'm looking at one page here, and there must be 100 on here of different bands. You know, it's just one of them time periods. The bands in the 80s that were coming out of Boston were more and more together because Boston's scene was really starting to happen. Boston and Worcester and places like that were like jumping with these kinds of acts and also jumping with the different bars. Bunraddy's, you know, the ones all in Cambridge. But when it came down to it, the channel was a big key because it had so many different kinds of genres of music.
Yeah.
And that was the key. I mean, when you look at it, there was Mod Todd was playing DJ on certain nights because he was doing that. DJ John Marino was doing that for the metal, extreme, stuff like that and what have you. You were doing it because you were over with all the music, with everything, you know. And then it sort of... went into these different things later on. By 89, it's gone into you know, the main genres of, like I said, different styles of metal. And then when you start going into the later on, you got the locals like Me and the Boys, which is Brian Washburn that worked there and stuff, and that also had a band that was, you know, really good at what they did.
And he booked all the local stuff.
Yeah, he did. And then you had people like Tom Hambridge with TH and the Wreckage and stuff like that. You had all kinds of Boston blues band, you know, that kind of stuff, and White Knight, George Mental, Richard Nolan and the Naked Cage House Band. You know, there's all these different bands that came through, and people that were calling them, even though they were different names, they were in a lot of them, they were in the same bands, you know.
Yeah, I remember night that Johnny Winter and Edgar Winter played on the same stage.
Yeah.
For the first time.
Yeah.
And they didn't even talk to each other.
No.
They didn't say a word to each other. Everybody figured the two of them were going to get together for an encore, and they never did.
Yeah.
They never did.
So anyway, any more before we go? Because we've had a good conversation here, Bradley. You're really good at this stuff, you know. And I mean,
Before I go, I want to let everyone know that if you go to bostonsbestliverock.com, it shows year by year who played and the date and everything.
That's me. I put all that up.
That's stinky.
That's you? Okay. That's really cool. That's how you find it. Boston's Best Live Rock, Vanilla Fudge, January 27th.
There you go. Okay. I know that's how you're doing it the same way. I've got them all here on paper so I don't have the computer with me and stuff, what have you. But no, yeah, as you know, you had fun there, and that's the thing, especially like you say with them big silver horses and that DJ booth, because it would rack the, you know, ruin the place in a way, boom, boom, boom. But it was great because it made you move, no matter what you played.
And you know what? People who were there heard people like Bradley on the radio.
Oh, totally.
But they never saw him, you know.
No.
And all of a sudden, I know that voice. I know that dude.
Exactly.
And, you know, you think of the average guy from Revere or Chelsea, whatever, who listened to the radio.
Yeah.
You know, they never had an interaction or a sight line.
No.
With a real radio personality, other than, you know, somebody getting on stage to introduce a band.
Yep.
But there you were in the booth in the flesh.
We're just hanging out so you can talk.
Exactly.
See,
right.
You
can have a beer or whatever.
That's it. I mean, there were, you know, the people like you too came in the back room and watching them. There was metal bands from, you know, Metallica to White Lion, and all them guys were coming in after
White Lion. Holy cow.
Came in and whatever. There was just, used to, you know, the pop in, and then other artists that were in town that night, they would end up either at the Rat for a while, and then all of a sudden they'd be over the channel because the headliners were, wow, we've got this in the club after 12 o'clock at night. This is fantastic and stuff. We're party people too, you know.
I had a good time, you guys. Thank you very much.
Hey, man, it was good talking to you, kid.
Thank you very much for the channel podcast, Two Pints in a Corner. And we are now signing out with Bradley J. And thank you again, Bradley.
Thank you both so much. Take care.
See you, Bradley.
Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.